AU Press presents Unforgetting Private Charles Smith, narrated by Simon Kerwin. This work is copyrighted 2019, Jonathan Lockhart, and published by AU Press. Cover design by Marvin Harder. We acknowledge the financial support of the Government of Canada for our publishing activities and the Canada Council for the Arts, which last year invested $153 million to bring the arts to Canadians throughout the country, as well as the assistance provided by the Government of Alberta through the Alberta Media Fund. About the author. Jonathan Lockhart is a Canadian poet and literary scholar affiliated with Harvard University, Cambridge University, and University of Toronto. His recent work in comparative literature includes The Poetics of Otherness, War, Trauma, and Literature. Dedication. For my father, George Edward Hart, 1914 to 2018. Epigraph. Quote, "Who will remember, passing through this gate, the unheroic dead who fed the guns?" End quote. Siegfried Sassoon. Contents. Part 1. Against Remembrance. Page 1. Part 2. The Diary of a Trench Soldier, a poem in his own words. Page 35. Part 1. Against Remembrance. When I first met him, Private Charles Smith had been dead for close to a century. I no longer remember precisely when I came across his small diary in the Baldwin Collection of Canadiana at the Toronto Reference Library. With its dark plastic cover and metal ring binding, it is an unremarkable object, every bit as nondescript as its author's name. The entries begin on the 5th of June 1915. The final one is dated 31st of May 1916. 11 months or so of Smith's life pinned to the lined pages, without past or future. I had for some time been interested in poetry and the remembrance of war, not only in the representation of war in poetry, but also, and especially, in whose poetic voices are privileged in our collective memory. War poetry typically has an agenda, be it to glorify or condemn, and implicit in remembrance is always a forgetting. I first saw Smith's diary around the time that I was writing a paper for a conference on the British Empire and the First World War, to be held in Singapore in February 2014, and my topic concerned, in part, the recruitment of Indigenous soldiers into the Canadian Army. These soldiers had, unsurprisingly, been rendered all but invisible in standard imperial histories of the war. That they be effaced was required by the self-serving logic that undergirds the colonial project, including its wars. And now here was Charles Smith, who was, I later discovered, firmly Anglo-Canadian, born in Kent. Yet he too had been forgotten, along with countless other regular soldiers from ordinary families. Charles Smith was no one and anyone. In its lack of concrete referent, his name was like all the other names I had seen on gravestones, cenotaphs, and other monuments to the dead. At first, I had no information about him other than what appeared in the diary itself. Chas Smith, number McG173, 3rd Company Princess Patricia Light Infantry, British Expeditionary Force. And above the first entry, sworn in 5th of June 1915. Evidently, then, Smith had received training through the McGill University contingent of the Canadian Officers Training Corps and had subsequently been sent overseas as a member of the Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry. At the front of the diary, Smith had written, "Please return to Mrs. E. E. Smith, 16 Geneva Avenue, Toronto." Was Mrs. E. E. Smith his mother? Some other relative? I did not know. Only slowly did my unforgetting take shape. The first detailed entry is dated Monday, the 28th of June, 1915. Not much to do today. Had most of the day off. Paraded at 7 p.m. in full marching order. Left parade ground 7:30, bound for boat. Got a good send-off. sailing on SS Northland, the diary continues in the same matter-of-fact style, was on duty all last night. Today, whilst on lookout, three bullets struck the chimney just behind me. Weather fine and cool. Tramp. Weather hot in day, rain at night. Footnote number one. Footnote reads, entries for Saturday, the 2nd of October, 1915, and Tuesday, 9th of May, 1916, Diary of Charles Smith, Baldwin Collection of Canadiana, Marilyn and Charles Bailey Special Collection Centre, Toronto Reference Library, call number 8VO. Text. Smith was not writing to express himself, to record his thoughts, his emotions, his opinions. He was simply writing down what happened in telegraphic style. As part of my historical research, I decided to transcribe his diary. In the age of digital scanning, this might seem a peculiar choice, and yet the very laboriousness of the process obliged me to focus my attention on the words I was copying. I continued my work for some time whenever I visited the Toronto Reference Library, engaging in my own form of archiving, almost like a ritual of remembrance. The voice was his own, full of life. A man in the trenches asserting the individuality of his experience in the vastness and inhumanity of the war. As I transcribed his words, I gradually became alert to their rhythm and cadence, and I found myself wanting to bring forth the poetry I was hearing. As usual, words imprint themselves on me, forming patterns, and a poem begins. In some ways, this poem came fast, as I was merely the scribe to Smith's muse, arranging the score of his composition. I read the poem to my father, then in his late 90s and still writing poetry himself. When I finished, he asked me a simple question. Did Smith die, and is that why the diary ends? His question took me by surprise. I thought back to the unforgettable final entry, back at 11 a.m. I was aware that this entry, dated the 31st of May 1916, was followed by many blank pages, an emptiness that, I realised in retrospect, should have been its own statement. And yet, for some reason, I had vaguely imagined that the young man whose words I had borrowed eventually returned home, or, if nothing else, that his fate was unknown. The next time I went to the archives, I asked the librarians whether they had any information about Smith. The Baldwin collection had since moved, early in 2014, into the newly opened and suitably sleek Marilyn and Charles Bailey Special Collections Centre on the library's fifth floor. When the collection was moved, the old card catalogues, presumably thought too unsightly, had been hidden away, out of easy reach to researchers, even though not all the information on the cards had been digitised. Another form of forgetting, out of sight, out of mind. A librarian went and fetched the card for Smith's diary, and this is what we read. Quote, Smith, Charles, died 1916. Diary, 28th of June to 1915 to 31st of May 1916, 1V. Charles Smith was a private in the 3rd Company of the Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry. He joined the Army on the 5th of June 1915 as part of the McGill University Company 2nd Reinforcement Draft. He was killed at the Battle of Mount Sorrel at Sanctuary Wood the 2nd of June 1916. Before the war, Smith had lived in Toronto with his father, Arthur W. Smith, a painter at the T. Eaton Company. He himself is listed in the Toronto Directories, 1910 to 1915, as a clerk. Portrait picture, account 990-6, end quote. Text. Suddenly, I was overwhelmed with recognition. I had seen this card once before, years earlier. Now memory returned. I had explained that I was interested in biographical information about soldiers who fought in the Great War and had asked the librarians what the Baldwin collection contained by way of diaries or letters or other such first-hand records. That was how I discovered Smith's diary. But I had completely forgotten what the card said. Indeed, I had forgotten its very existence. And so my father was right. The diary ended 2 days before Smith was killed. since 1916 was a leap year, he had died 363 days after enlisting in the army. He knew that he was sometimes only a few seconds or inches away from death, and yet, transcribing the diary, I had somehow assumed that this was the voice of a man who would survive the battle and come home. He did not. The card indicated that there was a photograph, and I asked to see it. In the course of my work, my mind had formed its own rather blurry portrait of Smith, a young, generic face with a look of nobility and determination, my condensation of countless images that I had seen over the years. Now this private portrait gave way to an actual faded photograph with the sepia tint so popular at the time. A nice-looking young man in uniform, wearing a cap that seemed too wide for his narrow face, his expression serious but uncertain. The Baldwin Collection had no other information about Smith or his family, but Library and Archives Canada holds extensive personnel records from the First World War, many of which have been digitized. This was how I found Smith's attestation paper, which is dated 5th of June 1915, the day he volunteered for service. Recruits were asked 12 questions to which Smith had responded as follows. 1. What is your name? Charles Smith. 2. In what town, township or parish and in what country were you born? New Eltham, Kent, England. 3. What is the name of your next of kin? Arthur Smith, father. 4. What is the address of your next of kin? 16 Geneva Avenue, Toronto. 5. What is the date of your birth? July the 27th, 1893. 6. What is your trade or calling? Student, Chartered Accountant's Office. 7. Are you married? No. 8. Are you willing to be vaccinated or revaccinated? Yes. 9. Do you now belong to the active militia? Yes. QOR. 10. Have you ever served in any military force? QOR, 2.5 months. 11. Do you understand the nature and terms of your engagement? Yes. 12. Are you willing to be attested to serve in the Canadian Overseas Expeditionary Force? Yes. Below this were two signatures, Smith's own and that of a witness, Guy P. Dunstan. Recruits were then required to make a declaration and swear an oath. The declaration reads, quote, I, Charles Smith, handwritten, do solemnly declare that the above answers made by me to the above questions are true, and that I am willing to fulfil the engagements by me now made, and I hereby engage and agree to serve in the Canadian Overseas Expeditionary Force and to be attached to any arm of the service therein for the term of 1 year, or during the war now existing between Great Britain and Germany, should that war last longer than 1 year, and for 6 months after the termination of that war, provided His Majesty should so long require my services, or until legally discharged. End quote. The oath follows, quote, I, Charles Smith, handwritten, do make oath that I will be faithful and bear true allegiance to His Majesty King George V, his heirs and successors, and that I will, as in duty bound, honestly and faithfully defend His Majesty, his heirs and successors, in person, crown, and dignity against all enemies, and will observe and obey all orders of His Majesty, his heirs and successors, and of all generals and officers set over me. So help me God. End quote. Both are signed by Smith and duly witnessed by Dunstan, but this is not the end of it. Below Smith's declaration and oath is a statement signed by a magistrate who certifies that he has cautioned the recruit that, were he to provide false answers to any of the preceding questions, he would be liable to be punished as provided in the Army Act. The magistrate further attests that the above questions were then read to the recruit in my presence and that I have taken care that he understands each question. His declaration is followed by a final statement from the approving officer, likewise signed and dated, certifying that the above is a true copy of the attestation of the above named recruit. Footnote number 2. Footnote reads, this document can be viewed at item Smith Charles, MCG 173, Library and Archives Canada, http://www.bacdlac.gc.ca/ENG/itemwarld-aR4/personnel records PERSONNEL=IT-EM.ASPX?235643. Text. The document complete, Smith was no longer a civilian. The war had been underway for barely 10 months when Smith signed away his freedom. He was about 7 weeks shy of his 22nd birthday. He would not live to see his 23rd. I wondered how, in that moment, Smith understood the nature and terms of his engagement. The declaration commits him to serve at least until the end of the war or until legally discharged. No mention of death here, or even injury. And yet he must have known that he might not survive. Did he sign up because his heart was moved by patriotic spirit? Or was he simply doing what other young men were doing? His motives are irretrievable, and they may have been obscure even to him. I hope to discover more about the circumstances of his death in the Battle of Mount Sorrel. In one of its collections, RG150, 1992-93/314, Library and Archives Canada holds records pertaining to the death of service personnel. Volumes 145-238, Circumstances of Death Registers, also known as the Brown Binders, consist of records kept by the Overseas Ministry that specify the circumstances under which someone died and the location of the cemetery in which the person was first buried. These records have also been digitized, and I was excited to think that I might finally learn precisely how Charles Smith died and what became of his body. Excited, that is, until I reached the content list at the bottom of the webpage and reread the important note. Volumes containing names beginning by SIP to Z have not survived. Footnote number 3. Footnote reads, see Circumstances of Death Registers, First World War, Library and Archives Canada, http://www.bacdlac.gc.ca/eng/discover-mass-digitized-archives/mass-digitized-archives Circumstances Death Registers, CIRCUMSTANCES-DEATH-REGISTERS/PAGES/ Circumstances Death Registers, CIRCUMSTANCES-DEATH-REGISTERS.ASPX. Text. Suddenly, Smith seemed doubly dead, and not merely because he did not survive, and then neither did the documentation. With the loss of the record, the specificity of his death had also been expunged. I had the attestation paper to mark the beginning, but I was missing the end. There is no individual record, no death certificate. Browsing at random through other records, I realized, by way of cold comfort, that had Smith's own survived, it might very well have said no more than killed in action. Some of the forms do contain additional information, but for the most part the entries are terse and perfunctory. In his Official History of the Canadian Army in the First World War, Canadian Expeditionary Force 1914-1919, Colonel G.W.L. Nicholson provides a detailed account of the battle in which Smith was killed. The Battle of Mount Sorrel took place in western Belgium on a ridge not far east of the town of Ypres, in an area known to military historians as the Ypres Salient. At the time, Allied forces controlled territory to the west of the ridge, including Ypres itself, while German forces were arrayed to the east. From the village of Hoche, roughly due east of Ypres, the ridge curves to the south through Sanctuary Wood as far as a pair of adjacent hills, Hill 62, or Tor Top, and Hill 61. Extending west from these two hills is a spur of land, aptly named Observatory Ridge, that affords an excellent view of the area around Ypres. From Hill 61, the ridge continues southward to Mount Sorrel, north of which is Armagh Wood, and then to Hill 60, not far east of the village of Zillebeke, known to Nicholson as Zwartelien. Footnote number 4. Footnote reads, for a map of the battle area as it was on the 2nd of June 1916, see Mount Sorrel, CanadianSoldiers.com, CanadianSoldiers.com, https://www.canadiansoldiers.com, that's www.canadiansoldiers.com/history, history, /battle honours, battle honours, Western Front, WESTERNFRONT, /Mount Sorrel, MountSorrel.htm. The description of the battle provided on this page draws heavily on Nicholson's account. Text. At the start of the battle, this crucial area was occupied by infantry units belonging to the 3rd Division of the Canadian Corps, including Smith's Regiment, the Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry, which was stationed in Sanctuary Wood. Not surprisingly, advancing German forces were intent on dislodging the Canadians from their advantageous position on the ridge. As Nicholson explains, quote, this part of the Canadian line formed the most easterly projection of the Ypres salient into enemy territory. The challenge to German aspirations presented by this obtrusion was the greater in that the 3rd Division sector included the only portion of the crest of the Ypres Ridge which had remained in Allied hands, a tenure which gave the Canadians observation over the enemy trenches. End quote. Footnote number 5. Footnote reads, Colonel G.W.L. Nicholson, Official History of the Canadian Army in the First World War, Canadian Expeditionary Force 1914-19, Ottawa, Queen's Printer 1962, https://dhh-dhp/his/docs/HIS/DOCS/CCE.PDF, page 147. Page numbers are hereafter provided in the text. End quote. Nicholson further notes that if the Germans were to capture Tor Top, they would gain a commanding position in the rear of the Canadian lines and might well compel a withdrawal out of the salient, page 148. Indeed, two infantry divisions of the German 13th Württemberg Corps had for the past 6 weeks been stealthily preparing just such a blow, page 148. The Canadian forces were aware that the Germans were planning an attack. As Nicholson puts it, warnings were not lacking. Quote, during May, Canadian patrols reported that German engineers were pushing saps forward on either side of Tor Top. These progressed slowly but steadily in spite of our artillery and machine guns, and before the end of the month, a new lateral trench connected the heads of the saps, now 50 yards in advance of the main front line. The same kind of thing was going on south of Mount Sorrel and at other points beyond. Other indications of forthcoming action appeared in the bringing up of large-caliber trench mortars and abnormal activity by the enemy's artillery, aircraft and observation balloons. Weather conditions, however, prevented systematic observation of the German rear areas, and the absence of significant troop movements seemed to signify that the looked-for attack was not imminent, page 148. End quote. In diary entries for May, Smith mentions periodic shelling, including a piece of shrapnel that hit him in the back. "Felt very nervous," he writes. He cannot possibly have been oblivious to the impending assault. All the same, Canadian troops were caught off guard when, on the morning of the 2nd of June, heavy German bombardment began. "For 4 hours," Nicholson writes, "a veritable tornado of fire ravaged the Canadian positions," page 148, "with one battalion, the 4th Canadian Mounted Rifles, all but annihilated, 9 out of 10 injured or killed," page 149. The German fire increased in intensity throughout the morning, and shortly after 1 p.m, the Württembergers exploded 4 mines just short of the Canadian trenches on Mount Sorrel and then attacked, page 149. Nicholson paints a grim portrait. Quote, "There were brief episodes of hand-to-hand fighting with bomb and bayonet, and where sheer numbers were not sufficient to overcome resistance, the enemy used flame projectors. The machine guns of Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry and the 5th Battalion, 1st Division, on the left and right flanks, raked the attackers. Though they inflicted substantial casualties, they could not halt the advance," pages 149 to 50, end quote. One of the companies in Smith's regiment was overrun. A second managed to hold out for some 18 hours, isolated from the rest of the battalions and with all its officers killed or wounded, while Patricia companies to the rear bore the brunt of the fighting. In Nicholson's description, "resolute detachments held successive blocks in the communication trenches, and the enemy's advance was over the dead bodies of each little garrison in turn," page 150. Reading Nicholson's account, I began to understand why the entries in the circumstances of death registers are often so laconic. If a fallen soldier lived long enough to be taken to hospital, or at least to a place of safety, the nature of his wounds might be recorded, and or a survivor might later recall what had happened. Witnesses to the death of those killed in the chaos of battle, however, might have been dead themselves only minutes later, or, if they survived, they might not be able to recollect what they saw. Trauma often blots out memory. The beginning of the Battle of Mount Sorrel is also described on the website of Veteran Affairs Canada. Quote, "In the fiercest bombardment yet experienced by Canadian troops, whole sections of trench were obliterated and the defending garrisons annihilated. Human bodies and even the trees of Sanctuary Wood were hurled into the air by the explosions. As men were literally blown from their positions, the 3rd Division fought desperately until overwhelmed by enemy infantry. By evening, the enemy advance was checked, but the important vantage points of Mount Sorrel and Hills 61 and 62 were lost. A counterattack by the Canadians the next morning failed, and on June the 6th, after exploding 4 mines on the Canadian front, the Germans assaulted again and captured Hoche on the Menin Road." Footnote number 6. Footnote reads, Hill 62, Sanctuary Wood, Canadian Memorial, Veteran Affairs Canada, https://emg/memorials/first-world-war/WORLD-WAR/Belgium-BELGIUM-62 The memorial is a simple block of white granite from Quebec, on which is inscribed, "Here at Mount Sorrel, on the line from Hoche to Saint-Éloi, the Canadian Corps fought in the defence of Ypres, April to August 1916. During the Battle of Mount Sorrel alone, from the morning of the 2nd of June to the end of the 13th of June, some 8,430 men were killed, wounded, or reported missing." Text. The battle would continue until the wee hours of the morning of the 14th of June, when Canadian forces finally succeeded in recapturing their former position. Somewhere in this initial slaughter, Charles Smith was killed. He was joined in death that first day by roughly 150 other members of his regiment. but this does not ease the desperation of his struggle or render his death more bearable. Perhaps he was blown apart by an exploding shell, or perhaps he was killed by a bullet and his body then trampled beyond all recognition on a once lovely ridge overlooking Ypres. Back home in Toronto, his relatives would not have marked the moment when Smith ceased to be alive. In fact, quite possibly, they were still sleeping. Awake, they would have gone about their business, ignorant of their loss. But they would have been notified, and I wondered what they were told. Was his body ever recovered? Did he have a grave? Curious about his commemoration, I returned to Library and Archives Canada. Volumes 39 to 144 in the library's collection of death records contain grave registers for members of Canadian Expeditionary Force killed in Belgium, France, and the United Kingdom during the First World War. These registers, which are known as the Black Binders, include information about the cause and place of death, the date of burial, and the location of the grave. Like the Brown Binders, grave registers have been digitized, and in this case, the records from Small to Smith, PM, have not been lost. When I opened the digital copy, however, I discovered that it can be viewed only a single page at a time, and that it is not possible to search the volume, an effort to bury the burial, perhaps? Fortunately, the records do appear to be arranged alphabetically, and by a process of trial and error, I was able to locate a record for Charles Smith, footnote number 7. Footnote reads, see Commonwealth Grave Registers, First World War, Library and Archives Canada, http://www.bac-lac.gc.ca/eng/discoverer/mass-digitized-archives, that's mass-digitized-archives/commonwealth-war-graves-registers, commonwealth-war-graves-registers, commonwealth-war-graves-registers.aspx. Small to Smith PM is volume 31830_B016643, brackets RG150, 1992-93, pages 314 and 122. Smith's record appears on page 301 and page 302, text. Under cause and place of death, the record does indeed say no more than killed in action. Curiously, though, the date of death is given as 2/4-6-16. Scrolling page by page through the volume, I noticed several other such entries, such as 14/16-9-16 or 21/22-10-16, but I could find no explanation of the slash, other than the obvious one, lack of certainty. So, was Smith killed on the first day of the battle, as the Baldwin Collections card indicates, or did he fight on for two more days, only to die on the very eve of the one-year anniversary of his enlistment? I found myself hoping it was the first, not to deny Smith another few hours of life, but to spare him the pain of survival. I did not want to imagine him watching as hundreds of others died on all sides, wondering when his turn would come, or whether he would merely lose an arm, or a leg, or an eye, or a piece of his face. No date of burial is listed. Under place of burial, someone had neatly written Sanctuary Wood, Ypres, that is, the battlefield itself, but stamped across this are the words Menin Gate Memorial. There is also a stamp on the second page, Menin Reg Form sent 10/2/1925 TO, with Mr. A. Smith, 16 Geneva Avenue, Toronto, Ontario, written below in a different hand. There are no particulars, no information about the circumstances of his death or burial, but then one would not expect them, not in the case of a fallen soldier whose only grave is the Meningate Memorial to the missing. The registration form was sent to Smith's father while the memorial was still under construction, begun in 1923 and completed in 1927. The imposing structure stands on the east side of Ypres, beside a moat that formed part of the town's medieval fortifications. Like thousands upon thousands of other soldiers, Charles Smith would have marched along the route on which the memorial now stands, across the moat and onto the woods and ridges several kilometres ahead. Had he been asked, "Are you aware that you may not survive?" he probably would have replied, "Yes." But our death is an abstract idea. He could not have imagined the circumstances in which he would die, much less his final moments of consciousness. Nor could he have known that his name would one day be incised on a block of stone and incorporated into a monument to those whose bodies were never recovered, inasmuch as nothing remains to recover. Visitors enter the Menin Memorial through one of two soaring arches, one at the west end and the other at the east. At each entranceway is an inscription, composed no less by Rudyard Kipling: "To the armies of the British Empire who stood here from 1914 to 1918, and to those of their dead who have no known grave." The heart of the monument is the Hall of Memory, which stretches between the entranceways. Along the hall, on two levels, are seemingly endless lists of the dead, on a total of 60 stone panels, each containing many hundreds of names. Smith's name appears on panel 10, located on the south side of the hall, on the first level, just past the midway point if one is walking from the west. Without a guide to his whereabouts, one might search for days. There are more than 54,600 names. Footnote number 8. Footnote reads, "Ypres Meningate Memorial, Commonwealth War Graves Commission, https://www.cwgc.org/find-cemeteries-and-memorials-find-cemeteries-and-memorials-and-memorials-9180 Ypres Memorial, Ypres-Memorial. For an eloquent account of war memorials and the quest for consolation, see J. Winter, Sites of Memory, Sites of Mourning, The Great War in European Cultural History, Cambridge University Press, 1995. Text. Stepping inside the Meningate Memorial, visitors enter the realm of monumentality, of vast numbers that neatly elide the particularities of human struggle and death. For the purposes of monument, the value of an individual rests on the erasure of that individuality, allowing the person to become a unit capable of increasing a total. Oddly, then, in naming someone, such memorials confer anonymity. Who was Charles Smith, and does it matter? He is relevant only insofar as he is dead. It is hard to think that he earned his place there because in death he had no body, that there was too little left of him to permit identification, whether because he was blown to pieces or incinerated or crushed beneath the panic-stricken feet of others. Who wants to imagine the terror he felt or the pain? Such thoughts undermine commemoration. Canada has also claimed Smith as one of its fallen sons, as part of an ongoing effort to repatriate a war not her own. Canada did not choose to go to war with Germany. As Nicholson points out, in 1914, Canada's constitutional position within the empire gave her little share in formulating foreign policy, and none in declaring war or making peace. She found herself at war through the action of the British government. Footnote number 9. Footnote reads, Nicholson, Canadian Expeditionary Force 1914 to 1919, page 5. He goes on to quote from R. MacGregor Dawson's The Government of Canada, Toronto, University of Toronto Press, 1947, page 60. "She had not been consulted. She had herself made no declaration of war, and she had in no way taken part in the diplomatic exchanges which had led to the final catastrophe. Text. This does not, of course, alter the fact that Canadians fought and died in the war, but many of them, especially those who, like Smith, had been born in Britain, doubtless understood themselves as fighting on behalf of the mother country and her glorious empire. Footnote number 10. Footnote reads, indeed, in his diary, Smith recorded his regiment as the Princess Patricia Light Infantry, omitting the word Canadian, which he identified as part of the British Expeditionary Force rather than the Canadian Expeditionary Force. Text. All the same, Canada was swift to focus on commemoration. On the 1st of July 1917, nearly a year and a half before the war ended, Prime Minister Robert Borden dedicated a site on Parliament Hill for a memorial to the debt of our forefathers and to the valour of those Canadians who, in the Great War, fought for the liberties of Canada, of the Empire, and of humanity. The original plan was to inscribe on the walls of this monument the names of those who not merely fought, but were in fact killed in the course of this noble struggle. There were, however, too many names to be accommodated, and this plan was therefore jettisoned in favour of a book of remembrance that would list the names of the dead. The book, completed, ironically enough, in 1942, midway through the Second World War, contains the names of those who died fighting overseas during the First World War. There are 66,655 names. Smith's appears on page 164 of this mammoth roster, sandwiched alphabetically between a Lieutenant Cecil Parker Smith and a Private Charles Henry Smith. Footnote number 11. Footnote reads, see History of the Books, Library and Archives Canada, https://bac.gc.da/100/200/301/ic/can_digital/books/books/history/HISTORY.htm, where Robert Borden is quoted. The page containing Smith's name can be viewed at http://www.veterans.gc.da, that's /books/remembrance/remembrance/books/PAGE?164?BOOK?1 ampersand-BOOK?1 ampersand-SORT?PAGEASC.text. There are now 7 books of remembrance. These testaments to the slaughter of war reside in a structure known as the Peace Tower, although more formally it is the Tower of Victory and Peace. Peace is apparently what follows victory, although it could equally well follow defeat. And since one cannot have victory without war, one also cannot have peace without war. Moreover, as the books themselves attest, war entails death, and so peace is likewise impossible without the loss of life. To commemorate the dead, however, and thereby celebrate peace, a community must collectively choose to obscure the reality of death. Remembrance requires the transformation of human anguish into heroism, and this is possible only through selective forgetting. In the absence of this forgetting, it would be difficult to lure new generations into military service. More immediately, in Canada, this elision of death in the service of glorification held out the hope of national unity. Only the memory of the Great War, writes Jonathan Vance, could breathe life into Canada. Footnote number 12. Footnote reads, Jonathan F. Vance, Death So Noble, Memory, Meaning, and the First World War, Vancouver, University of British Columbia Press, 1997, page 11. As Vance observes, Canadians collectively refuse to countenance a preoccupation with the horrors of battle or with the grief of loss, preferring to see in the war the tool that could weld together the nation, page 11. Similarly, in his classic study of the apotheosis of the death, George Moss argues that the cult of the fallen soldier became the centerpiece of the religion of nationalism, in a process whereby the memory of the war was refashioned into a sacred experience. George L. Moss, Fallen Soldiers, Reshaping the Memory of the World Wars, New York, Oxford University Press, 1990, page 7, text. At the end of my quest, I found myself staring at a page on the website of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. Private Smith Charles G., service number M(c)G/173, died 02/06/1916, aged 21. Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry, Eastern Ontario Regiment, son of Arthur and Ellen Elizabeth Smith of 16 Geneva Avenue, Toronto. Suddenly, there was a middle initial which I had encountered nowhere else, and now I knew that Mrs. E. E. Smith was indeed his mother. I wondered whether it was she who gave his diary and photograph to the Baldwin collection. Curiously, when I returned to the Baldwin collection to arrange for a copy of the photograph so that it could be included in this book, it had vanished. The most plausible explanation seemed to be that it had been taken out for use in a commemorative display in connection with the war's centennial and subsequently then misfiled, a literal effacement, ironically the product of remembrance. Finally, after months of searching, the library staff located it, and almost as miraculously, Smith's face was restored. The before, I thought, looking at him again, trying hard not to imagine the after. What then of poetry? One thinks of Wilfred Owen, Hed Wynne, Rupert Brooke, Owen killed by machine gun fire only a week before Armistice Day, Wynne fatally wounded on the first day of the Battle of Passchendaele, Brooke dead at sea of septicemia en route to the Dardanelles for the Gallipoli campaign. We think as well of Robert Graves, so badly wounded at the Battle of the Somme that he was reported dead, although in time he recovered, and of his friend Siegfried Sassoon, another survivor, honoured for his bravery, and yet, by 1917, already a caustic critic of the war. In Canada, we think of Lieutenant Colonel John McCrae, teacher, field surgeon and poet, who died of pneumonia in January 1918 in an officer's hospital in Britain. Charles Smith was not an officer. Unlike McCrae, he did not write in Flanders Fields or earn a page of his own on the website of Veterans Affairs Canada, nor is the house in which he was born now a museum. Footnote number 13. Footnote reads, Lieutenant Colonel John McCrae, Veteran Affairs Canada, http://www.veterans.gc.ca/ENG, remembrance, remembrance, history, history, WORLD, FIRST WORLD WAR, MCCRAE. Text. As far as we know, he never aspired to a career in poetry. His father worked as a painter for a department store, and it seems that Charles hoped to become an accountant. He enlisted in the army, was sent to Belgium, and died. So did thousands of other young men. When I created a poem from the words in Smith's diary, I did so mostly for myself. It was my way of internalizing his experience. I did not set out to appropriate the prosaic words of an ordinary soldier and elevate them to status of poetry. There was no need. They were already poetry, although perhaps with one exception. Poets, by which I mean people who think of themselves as poets, write with readers in mind and craft their words accordingly. They have one eye on their literary reputation. Whatever else, Smith almost certainly did not conceive of his diary as literature. Quite possibly this was private writing, a putting of words on paper with no expectation that someone else would one day read them. Perhaps Smith silently hoped that he would return from the war, and that these staccato words would someday serve as an aide-memoire, notes from which stories could then be elaborated. It is a reassuring vision. Then again, whether consciously or not, Smith may have been writing for his mother and father, and possibly for his siblings, if he had any. Please return to Mrs. E. E. Smith. The request says so much. Perhaps Smith was creating his own memorial, something for his parents to cherish after he was gone, something that, as it turned out, would have to stand in place of his body. This could be why he did not speak of his emotions. Perhaps he felt that such accounts would be too painful to read or to write. Perhaps he could live only by immersing himself in the mundane and immediate and concrete. What follows is his poem, not mine, although I do think of it as a sort of memorial to his memorial, one dedicated to life rather than death. Smith wrote for those who would continue to live without him, but always remembering him. For once, I want to forget the long lists and massive monuments, and instead unforget a single soldier, summon him back to life. Part 2. The Diary of a Trench Soldier, a poem in his own words. June 1915. We did not have much to do today. Left the parade grounds, bound for the boat. Got a good send-off on the SS Northland. July 1915. Old England at last. We passed Eddystone Lighthouse, sighted a couple of steamships. Trainless through the porthole. The country is beautiful, but a rotten fog came down on us, the church bell ringing. And the echo there. We received our Lee Enfields, whose bayonets were long and can do damage. Folkestone is a dead place, only kids and misfits. The Minister of Militia and High Commissioner kept us standing about for 2 hours. Tradesmen soak us. August 1915. Bonner Law inspected us. It rained and rained. Nearly everybody had passes for London. A good assortment of officers, including some Hindus. I walked the streets. In evening, not crowded. Girls bold, weather good. In the British Museum, we saw the Wicked Bible. Thou shalt commit, and the wicked shall inherit. Another day, past chateaus all closed up. A great country is France. Villages dot the country. The children are anxious. To know if we are downhearted, we passed a gang of German prisoners working in the limestone quarry. Our huts have flowers in the garden. Nothing doing. Weather fine. A medical inspection that was not. Train journey. Not so beautiful country as in England or Normandy. Carriage is rotten. At night I went to sleep myself, my leg, my arm. Weather hot. September 1915. It is hard to realise we are at war. A brigadier general inspected us, and we showed him how we would take a German trench, digging till midnight. Just behind the monastery, once under shell fire and now only a frame left, the weather is good for digging. I saw anti-aircraft fire getting right after a plane that fired more than 4 dozen shots at me. In Dieppe, I met a girl. The Germans bombed Armentières for an hour. I saw a great battle in the air. In the night, a fierce bombardment by our lines. Some scrap. We could hear the machine guns. All at once our plane dived straight down. I thought he had been brought down. The observer was killed in the air. We hear that the enemy are going to flood us out. Nothing to do all day. What would some think to see us eating under the trees? Not the horrors of active service. We are bivouacked in a field, shaded by trees, slept under the heavens in good weather. Nothing much doing all day. We started a digging expedition. Behind our trenches, Fritz sent up a flare. Some are like a parachute, go up like a rocket and shoot out and float slowly along the lines. Rain whilst digging. Some night last night, we had stripped and slept in underwear. It started to rain and rained all night. I slept in a pool of water, weather rotten. We had built it at a barn. Soldiers delight, fleas, mice, flies, British and French gains, weather fair. We moved a bit further up. There I saw a fine dugout that could hold 1,000 men. We patrol the marches, no trenches here. I was on the lookout, 13 hours on and off, weather cool. October 1915. The French know about barbed wire entanglements. On duty upstairs, I heard the moan of the air as the shell cut through. I was on duty last night. Today, whilst I was on lookout, 3 bullets struck the chimney behind me. The Germans shelled our billets when I was on duty upstairs. I heard the moan of the air as the shell cut through. We have installed and cleaned a stove sideboard, have chairs, tables, feather mattresses. The rain has come. We have tea, sugar, bacon, cold roast, cheese biscuits, bread, jam, spuds, apple sauce, porridge. Cushing Minor thought the waterfall sounded like a zeppelin. Yesterday the Germans dropped 11 shells, 7 of which did not explode. We had a good joke on Captain Jones. He stepped out of his dugout and saw the men wearing their smoke helmets. They told him a gas attack was on. He ordered all helmets off. It turns out that chloride of lime had been put in the trench and around the latrines. Poor chaps were overcome. They were so excited they chewed the mouthpieces and have to get new helmets. 3 to the right and I in front. Shrapnel. 1 shot struck a young tree and broke it. When a shell passes overhead, it makes a sinister shriek. Macpherson made a splendid pudding of dates and biscuits. The weather was foggy at night, late dawn. The same old thing. The transports had a time getting down the hill and one bucked into our billet. We loaded stones onto wagons. We had a game of lacrosse with shovels and tin of bully tied with cloth. The second half was not played. We took the wood without bloodshed. The weather was miserable. November 1915. Last Sunday was Halloween. We had several parcels and celebrated. Bully beef works wonders. For a few tins, we get all the fresh vegetables we want. A fine sun is out. We had a bath at a factory. Cushing found a French family where we go and read and write. The kitchen was a model of its kind. In the concert given by our company, we had songs, comic and serious, and a sketch about a veterans' club. In 1964, the weather was fine. Payday. We had a grand feed. Roast beef, potatoes, salad, rum cake, apples, café. The first snow fell, about 4 inches. Snow again. Same parades. A hard frost covered all the trees and fields. Our billet was a big barn. These French people speak good English. There are spasms of sun, hail, snow, rain. Nothing doing. Weather dull. General Alderson welcomed us to Canadian Corp. In the evening, we had a great feed on Norman's Christmas parcels, ox tongue, chicken, and so on. A good rain. December 1915. I inspected an old windmill here. Each had carved his name on the beams. The earliest date was 1532. Another date was 1763. The weather is good. We had a battalion route march for about 2.5 hours. We had a beautiful time wading through the mud. Nothing much doing. We went joyfully to Bailleul, only 6 miles, to take a bath in a lunatic asylum, in a pool 16 times 16 and 4.5 feet deep. Only about 600 had been before us. In all, we had 3 baths, one going, one there, one coming back. 2 were in sweat, weather wet. Nothing doing. Same. Lieutenant Colonel Pelly said goodbye to us. He is a splendid man, a gentleman from his head down. The weather is fine and cold. I had ordered some oil of cedar for my lice, but Selfridge and Company sent O-cedar oil for polishing piano furniture. They must think that we have pretty Jake trenches. Nothing doing. We moved up to the reserves. We have to wade through mud ankle deep. The Germans this day tried to take Kemmel, but were foiled by our artillery. We knew the attack was coming off, so when Fritz started his bombardment, our guns were some other place. Next came the gas, but the wind was treacherous and blew some of it back. Next came the infantry's turn, but our gunners were back again and lined his parapets with shrapnel, so he could not get out. The attack ended in the worst kind of a fizzle. Rain all day. Fritz shelled the road, and so we turned off and waded through mud knee-deep. We saw the shells burst close. We could hear the whiz after we saw the flash of the bursting shell. We worked till midnight, sandbagging, building up the parapet. A fair amount of shelling. We returned through Kemmel. The church is badly ruined, with large gaps in the tower and also the school. The weather is still wet. Christmas Day in the reserves. There was Holy Communion at Bailleul. We went in motor transports. Norm and I had eggs and chips for tea. The weather is good. When it does not rain, the sun shines. As a rule, we get 4 hours sunshine. Work patrol at night. Through Kemmel, we were filling sandbags. The bullets began to whiz around. Weather fair. Pulling up barbed wire, we came home soaking wet. Fritz was shelling the village. One shell landed just ahead of us at the crossroad. If we had been a quarter of a minute ahead, it would have landed in our midst. We were issued with waterproof capes. We moved off and came back to our same old billet. Jenny was glad to see us. Also, Belgium. We have back our little room with 5 table lamps. January 1916. We had a great New Year's feed. Jenny fixed up 2 chickens with rice, pickles, rolls, tomato sauce, plum pudding, cake, apples, cigs, coffee. A full feeling afterwards. Weather fine. It rained for about 2 hours. Mess orderly today. I had to go to Flêtre to get up rations. We had a hot argument about Russia. Had she done anything in this war? The weather is good. Fritz started it. He started to feel out a battery and put his shells about 3 fields away from us. He put about 6 shells over when about a dozen of our batteries opened out on him. It was pretty hot for an hour. About 2 dozen whiz-bangs skimmed us, just dropping over the barbed wire. Weather bon. An Allemann aeroplane came right over our camp. Parts of anti-aircraft shells dropped near us. Weather good. We are on ground level. Our trench is made of sandbags banked with earth in front. Instead of digging in, we build up. Weather fine. Gas alarm. Gas was expected, so had to have a steel helmet handy. February 1916. We have our cooks up with us this time. The glory hole is on our right. The trenches are rotten, can be enfiladed, and are only 35 yards from the Germans. Fritz's favourite pastime is sending over sausages. I'm happy to say that he never gets anybody. A quiet day. Pilot was killed on patrol with Perk. Ham. The weather was good. Corporal Millen was killed in our trench by a sniper about 800 yards away to our right. The weather was gloomy. We were relieved by the 49th. We came back to Locre in the Divisional Reserve. We had a big feed, and we were inoculated for I don't know what. Whilst in the trenches, we had a Prussian guard opposite us. They had some snipers. Their favourite pastime was breaking our periscopes. We have been recuperating from inoculation. Cold, snow and frost. Same old thing. Kemmel is a pretty place, well wooded with green fields around it. Out in morning carrying 60-pound bombs. Out again in evening for digging. Fritz sent over about 2 dozen sausages and shells into the glory hole, but did not get anybody. He knocked down 3 parapets. We are back to our huts in Kemmel. Yesterday an aeroplane dropped 6 bombs near the chateau. They were probably after the battery, but it was too close to be pleasant. They make a terrific explosion. We were out making dugouts. It was a beautiful day. The sky was full of planes and little white puffs of shrapnel. 2 bombs dropped 300 yards away from us and shook the ground where we were. March 1916. A beautiful day. No work party. Was out for drill. We moved off at 2 and we relieved the 49th at the glory hole amid much rain. I was on patrol with Morgan to the trenches on our right. It was snowing all night. The trenches were up to our calves in mud and water. This was the hardest night we have ever put in. We slept most of the day, making up for lost time. Heavy shrapnel dropped yesterday, which we saw bursting from the trenches. Very quiet. The weather was gloomy. A great day. The monastery at Mont des Cats was built in 1026, rebuilt 3 times. Payday. I consumed 5 eggs and sundry chocolate. Heavy shelling. In the front line, the 42nd and 49th got it badly. 57 passed through the dressing station. We were not hit, although shells burst around us. Weather good. Heavy shelling in the morning to our right of Saint-Éloi, where we took 600 yards of trenches. I could smell powder and sea smoke. I thought it was a big wave of gas at first. Miserable weather. We were relieved in the morning at 12:30. Fritz was relieved last night. We have not had much sleep during our 3 days in the trenches. It was a long march to the train, which took us to near Poperang. We arrived at our huts at 7:30 in the morning. It was a rotten night for relieving. It was hailing and blowing like fury, so it's hard to keep balance. Dark as the blazes. The flash of guns firing made matters worse. I found every hole to be found, including one up to my knee, filled with soft mud. Our travels were made joyful by the hail blowing in our face. We travelled along a trench, along a lake, that gave a strange eerie feeling as the waves lapped the side of the trench. April 1916. All muchly disgusted. Canon Scott of Montreal came in to see us and made a great hit with the fellows. He told us last time he was up at Ypres, he was staying at a place called Hell Corner. Weather hot. We were inspected by a Russian prince and also by the generals Alderson and Plummer and about 1 million staff officers. We moved away that night. We were shelled out in the evening and took to the trenches for about 1 hour. None of our chaps was hurt. An artilleryman was killed releasing the horses. The weather has been good. I left for Blighty, left Poperang for Boulogne, where I arrived, and then sailed, arriving at Folkestone and got to London 4 hours later. I was put up at the Maple Leaf at 5 Connaught Place. I had a bath, bed, pyjamas, dressing gown and slippers. I hardly recognised myself. The weather was good. I saw changing of the guard at the Palace and the Cheshire Cheese, a haunt of Dr. Johnson and Dickens's Royal Exchange. The old curiosity shop through Petticoat Lane and Covent Garden, St. Paul's. I left for Chislehurst. Weather good. I knew the place well. It was easy to find my way about. When I was a kid, I used to think the distance between two points long. Now find them very short. Miss Foster gave me a great welcome. One of the most enjoyable meals was a cold supper the first night here. The weather was good. Noticed the striking difference between here and Sanctuary Woods. Here all green, there all shell-strewn and battered up. I saw Mrs. Powell. I enjoy my meals immensely, quite homelike. Weather bon. I went to Woolwich. The model housing for munition workers there was very fine. I did not recognise grown-ups, but knew all my old chums. Names came easily. Weather, same. I left for London and did a little shopping. I felt very lonely in evening. The weather was the same. I left Victoria Station for Folkestone. We sailed, a rough passage across. One wave caught us broadside, sweeping the deck. I stayed at Boulogne, then entrained and left for Poperinghe after midnight. The weather was wet. A beautiful day. The birds sang. Easy digging. A shell fell about 10 after Fritz had put over about 30 high-explosive bombs within 100 yards of us. We were almost under one of his balloons and in sight of three, hence the shells. We cleaned out the dugout, which was in a fearful mess. Bombs sleep as we put in new sandbags. May 1916. Night patrol on Hell Street. Good digging. We heard the cuckoo and the skylark. About four naval 6 inches landed about 100 yards away. No one hit. I heard nightingale. The trees were all out in bloom. It is hard to realise that a war is on a quiet day. A 6-inch shell came over. The 49th was badly shelled and had between 70 and 80 casualties. Fritz put up a sign that Kut had fallen and that the war would be over in 2 weeks. Fritz put up a sign that no British troops would be in the salient by May the 10th. Work party. We have had a Jake time. There was hardly any shelling and only 2 casualties in 8 days. One killed, one wounded. We moved up to supports on Hell Street. A good dugout. A shell landed near us. A piece caught me in the back, only making a bruise. I dropped the wine and ran like anything for the trench. I wanted to get away from the place. I suffered a little from shock. I felt very nervous. I am sorry that it was not a blighty one. On guard at night, rather wet. Today is the anniversary of Pat's participation in the Second Battle of Ypres. Fritz searched for batteries. He must have put over 300 shells in the morning. We moved off in afternoon to camp. Tramp. The weather was hot in day, rain at night. I was mess orderly. No mail for a long time. Weather rainy and cold. This has been Unforgetting Private Charles Smith, by Jonathan Lockhart, narrated by Simon Kerwin, originally published by AU Press. Audiobook recorded by CNIB in its Toronto studio in 2022.